In a city where open spaces are scarce, many New Yorkers have been disturbed by the practice of selling or even giving away public parkland and historic sites to private developers in recent years. Attorney Jim Walden, the head of pro bono litigation for the law firm of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, has been challenging the legality of those transfers in court, including a recent case involving Brooklyn Bridge Park, as well as in a current lawsuit challenging the city's approval of the New York University expansion plan, which would destroy several parks and gardens in Greenwich Village. To find out more, we have invited Jim Walden to our show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
To begin with, what's the history of this kind of transfer of city-owned property? How far back does it go?
Well, it's not new to this administration. Certainly in the 1920s, for example, the administration at that time was trying to take a significant building within Central Park and lease it to a very worthwhile organization, but it was going to deprive the public of the use of that building, which was helping to support the park. And in that case, the Court of Appeals for New York said even though the organization was an extraordinarily worthwhile one, parkland is parkland. It can't be alienated even for 10 minutes.
Didn't that set a precedent?
It did. It set a precedent that virtually every court has followed in circumstances where the city or state tries to give away parkland. It's surprising that it still goes on, but it happens, unfortunately, all too often.
But that's parkland. I remember when Rudolph Giuliani tried to take over some community gardens, and there was a huge outcry. That's under different rules?
Well, not every community garden is the same, and the rules with respect to the Green Thumb program has changed. One of the problems is that the rules aren't always made available to the public, and people have an expectation that if they're involved in gardening and outdoor recreation in a space, it should be their space forever.
Well, do the mayor or the city council have the right to sell or give away city property at their discretion under certain circumstances?
A certain city property, yes, but parks are covered under a special rule. There's a specific part of the New York City General Law, Section 20, that says that parks, among other things, are inalienable. That's the language of the statute, and it seems like a pretty clear word to me.
Has the Bloomberg administration been involved in more of the deals that don't involve parks than previous mayors?
Well, certainly, I'm certainly more in tune to the issue, so I can't say that it happens more or less than other administrations. But what I can say is it's happening. It seems to be happening a lot now. We took one case to court in Brooklyn. We're taking the NYU case. There are people that are concerned about what's happening at Willets Point. Flushing Meadows Park is having the same problems. Macomb's Dam Park up by Yankee Stadium was closed for 4 years when people were supposed to have access to parks.
Does the status of public land depend on how the property came to be owned by the city, whether it was part of the original deal between the Dutch and the Indians or willed to the city by the owners, or whether the city took possession because of back taxes that were owed or some other reason?
It's complicated. There can be all of those things can be factors. But one thing that is absolutely clear in the law is where parkland is held out to the public as parkland for years, money going into it that's public money being supported by the Parks Department, that is an implied dedication regardless of what the original intent was.
So it doesn't matter whether someone bequeathed the land to the city to be used as a park or not.
If there was a specific reservation in the bequeathing document that said it can't be a park, that would be a relevant factor. But if the bequeath was just silent and then the city used it as parkland and held it out as parkland, then under the law it should remain a park.
And are they all under the jurisdiction of the Parks Department?
Well, there's different agencies that technically own some of the land. There are sometimes permits that are involved. But all of these kind of internal technical rules are not things that the public see, touch, and feel. What they know is if they're sitting under a tree on a bench and people are playing, then they experience it as a park, and the law protects the access to that parkland.
So a park can be administered by the Parks Department, but also by the Department of Housing Preservation and Development, HPD, the Department of Transportation, or NYCHA, the New York City agency, the New York City Housing Authority. Are there any other city agencies?
Well, the rule is that any city agency could technically own it. And in the tobacco warehouse case, the Brooklyn Bridge case, the city tried to skirt the rules. It was land that had been owned by the Parks Department and was transferred through a series of internal transfers to the General Services Administration. And so at the time that the court held that it was a park, it had to remain a park, it was technically titled to a completely different agency.
But that was the St. Anne's Warehouse case?
That was the case in which the city had signed a 99-year lease, or was planning to sign a 99-year lease with a very vibrant, popular theater that does a lot of good
work. I love that theater.
Oh, it's a fantastic organization. But if I told you that the city had the right to sign a 99-year lease with St. Anne's Warehouse, then they'd also have the right to sign a 99-year lease with the Federalist Society, and you might not be in favor of that. The rules were created to treat all parkland equally, regardless of whether the city wanted to give it to an organization we think of as good or one that we are not enthralled with.
So you were concerned about a precedent in that case?
It was a particularly disturbing case because of the number of agencies that got together to skirt the rules. I mean, literally, the National Park Service was in on this one, and the community had been trying to protect this as parkland since the 60s. A substantial amount of federal and state money went into this area that surrounded the warehouse, and the state parks, city parks, applied to the National Park Service to have it removed from the park, literally by a letter that the public never saw. The only reason the public found out about it is because an enterprising young law student named Andy Stengel made a FOIA request to get the documents, and that's how he found out that the National Park Service had put its imprimatur on the plan.
Do you know what's happened to the building in question?
The tobacco warehouse has been reopened, at least partially, to the public. And right now, I think the city's trying to figure out what to do. I think they're going to – now they're following an alienation process, which is the process they should have followed. And it may ultimately be that through an appropriate legal channel, St. Anne's warehouse will actually be in the tobacco warehouse only if the city comes up with adequate substitute parkland to replace the parkland that would be taken by St. Anne's.
My guest is Jim Walton, the head of pro bono litigation for the law firm Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. We've been talking about a number of lawsuits that challenge the city's approval of various transfers of parkland to private organizations. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can you tell us about the current case that you've brought against the city for their approval of the NYU 2031 expansion plan?
I'd love to. There are four parks on the site, the Mercer Playground, the Mercer Houston Dog Run, LaGuardia Corner Gardens, and LaGuardia Parks. And in various ways, the community has been using these things as parkland for an extraordinarily long time. There was an official dedication ceremony for the LaGuardia statue, which we all know, in 1994 in LaGuardia Park. There was a dedication ceremony for Mercer Playground, where there were four mayors attended some of these ceremonies. The head of the Parks Department itself, Henry Stern, participated in the dedication ceremony. Then Councilwoman Catherine Freed gave $250,000 in capital funds to develop these parks. And LaGuardia Corner Gardens, a beautiful space that the community's been using. I'm told that the community's been using that since about the time of Moses.
Not Robert Moses.
No. Well, certainly at least as long ago as Robert Moses. But there is an enormous amount of evidence, aside from people's everyday experience, that these are parks. And yet the city has decided that NYU can either have them or use them for 20 years.
But this doesn't involve some of the same issues as the Brooklyn Bridge Park case, does it?
Oh, it does. I mean, it does. Because these parks are protected by what's called the public trust doctrine. And the public trust doctrine is the same doctrine that was that I spoke about a couple of minutes ago in the Central Park case. These are either explicitly or implicitly dedicated parks, and they cannot be alienated without an act of the state legislature. And if any state or federal money was used to improve them, then substitute parkland has to be found before they can be taken away.
You are representing a wide variety of groups, including an NYU faculty group, the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation, and others. But why are you suing the city and not NYU?
Well, NYU is a necessary party, so they're involved in the litigation as well. But in these sorts of cases, you have to sue the decision maker. And here it's the City Planning Commission that ultimately gave the green light to the process, and the City Council ultimately approved it. And so those are the defendants that need to be sued in order to reverse the decision.
Now, Jennifer from the Rockaways asks, a listener asks, how was David Dinkins able to take Flushing Meadow and give it to the U.S. Tennis Association?
I'm not familiar with the circumstances of that, but I assume that he went through the appropriate channels or someone would have challenged it. The sad fact is, though, because the public does not have a clear understanding of all the laws that protect parks, they're not always as vigilant as they could be or should be in order to protect the parks that are important to them.
We've seen a lot of rezoning in recent years. How important a role does rezoning play in all of the things we're discussing?
Well, rezoning is certainly a part of the land use process that sometimes results in parkland being alienated. But I don't think that rezoning is as significant as an issue as the city finding justifications for developers to take parkland.
Well, there was a change in the zoning regulations in the NYU case, wasn't there?
There was.
There's also discussion. Increased density, concerns over the health and safety of area residents, even whether the university can afford to build it. But these are not your concerns here.
Well, they certainly are some of the concerns that we've stated in the NYU case. That's a case where we brought, I think, seven different claims. The parkland claim is just one of them, but we also challenged their decision to lift deed restrictions, for example. And so we attacked the ultimate decision on to approve the NYU case because of numerous legal deficiencies in the decision.
The case mainly concerns the four strips of land on Mercer Street and LaGuardia Place between Houston and West 3rd.
The park claim does. The first claim is the park claim, and that concerns those four strips.
They're small parks and gardens. What would happen to them under the NYU 2031 plan?
Well, two of them, NYU would just get outright. It would have the land, the gardens, and the parks would be gone. Two of them would be shuttered for long periods of time to stage the construction, and so they would not be accessible to the public.
And then the university intends to build high-rise buildings on some of this property?
They plan to overwhelm those two blocks with massive buildings. That's going to fundamentally change the character of the area.
What does the legal concept alienation of parkland refer to?
So the common law as early as the late 1800s, especially in urban areas, but this is true all over the state, accepted the notion that parks are sacred and that once the public has access to parkland, it's so important to spiritual and emotional well-being that the law should protect parks against any sort of giveaways. And judges in those days recognized that there may be a time where elected officials, for various reasons, might want to give away parks. And that's what the public trust doctrine was intended to prevent.
Is the city's attitude generally to allow the conversion of parkland to other uses unless it's challenged?
I think there are many circumstances, NYU and the Brooklyn Bridge Park case included, where the city hopes to sneak by without a lot of visibility or transparency to the public.
Would NYU pay the city for the land?
Well, they shouldn't be able to pay the city for
But if this went through?
No.
So this is not a matter of the city selling off some land that it feels it has no use for and can make some money fill the deficit budget, the deficit in the budget.
No, this case, just like many of the other cases where the city is challenged, they're essentially giveaways.
Isn't the land owned by the Department of Transportation?
The Department of Transportation holds title to the strips, but part of the proof in the case is we've made it very clear that the Department of Transportation always intended to transfer it to the Parks Department. In fact, Henry Stern, in an affidavit that he submitted in support of our case, said that that was the intention of the Parks Department all along. Frankly, since we've brought light to this issue, more public officials have come forward to say we either intended or believed that the transfer had actually happened. But whether it did or it didn't, the central issue is how were the parcels used by the public? The Parks Department signs are all over these parcels. The Parks Department takes care of them. Hundreds of thousands of dollars of public money has gone into them. They shouldn't just simply be given away to NYU or any other institution.
Is it true that this land is mapped as roadbed?
Yes, there was a
Has it ever been used as a road?
No, no, no. In the 1950s, there was a thought during Robert Moses's time to expand Mercer and LaGuardia, to expand those streets. That plan was abandoned by the early 60s.
That was to build this highway through Soho, Greenwich Village, and Washington Square Park that got Jane Jacobs to kind of challenge the way the city was being run, and Robert Moses especially.
Yes, and thank God for Jane Jacobs.
My guest is Jim Walden, who is the head of pro bono litigation for the law firm Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. We're talking about some of these cases that are challenging the legality of transfers of city property to private owners in the courts. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We also invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us, as some already have, on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also reach us through Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with Jim Walden, an attorney, the head of pro bono litigation for the law firm Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. We have a caller, Hannah, who asks about the practice of allowing restaurants and other food concessions in parks. Who decides those things?
The Parks Department, and there's been a number of lawsuits about these things called concessions, where they turn over a part of the park to a private party. There's some sort of revenue sharing agreement that's made, and courts have upheld that practice, which frankly, from my perspective, is a little bit of an encroachment on the public trust doctrine, but have allowed that as long as the concession is generally supportive of park services. So you can imagine if people want to buy a slice of pizza or they want to shop in a store, as long as it's related to the park purposes, courts will generally allow that.
And do they provide revenue for the parks?
They can provide revenue. It really depends on the deal that's been negotiated. I think one of the complaints has been that they don't provide enough revenue, that's one creative avenue that people have used to fund park services.
Do you know much about what happened with Tavern on the Green, which for a long time was a really popular restaurant and generated a lot of money and then went into total decline? Did the Parks Department play any role in the change?
I'm not really familiar with that specific case.
Let's take a call from Anna Lisa in Greenwich Village. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'm actually calling from the East Village.
Okay. Well, you're nearby.
Hi. Yeah. I was just wondering if you were aware of the NYCHA infill proposal. There's 8 sites citywide that NYCHA is proposing to lease out for 99 years to private developers to raise money, including a park on First Street between Avenue A and First Avenue.
I am familiar with the issue. I think that I've reviewed the deck of slides that NYCHA presented to the public when it first unveiled this plan.
Okay.
Now, what is the situation with the parks that are inside housing projects? Who controls those? Is that NYCHA?
It is NYCHA, and
They just build something else on them?
One of the issues there, I mean, first of all, from an implied dedication standpoint, if they've been used as parks, unless there's something that lets the public know that there is an ability to close the park, I certainly would argue in those circumstances that the city cannot close the parks without at least getting substitute parkland. I've been told, whether this is true or not, I don't know, that there's a specific reservation of rights in the title to those lands that makes it clear that they can't be parks. This is one of those areas where the bureaucracy can drive you crazy because it's a duck, they call it a cow, and it's just a bunch of bull. So people use these things as parks, and really the cases that I think are the most robust cases on the public trust doctrine say we've got to look at how the community experiences these, how the city holds them out to the public, regardless of what the paper trail says.
We have a call from Catherine. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
From Manhattan. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling about the case of, I mean, it's too late to do anything about it now, but there was a wonderful building that was the social Science Library at Hunter College at 79th Street on the east side. Isn't that public to some extent, too? It belongs to CUNY, and it was just torn down, and they're putting up this, expensive co-op high-rise building there. And it had an inner courtyard and garden. It was kind of quite very delightful property.
Well, Catherine, this actually brings up something a number of listeners have been asking about. For example, the Donnell Library in Midtown was sold to developers with the understanding that a library would be part of the structure. But is a similar situation, isn't it? Aren't there a number of historic buildings which are being eyed by developers, including some public libraries?
Absolutely. And this is driving preservation organizations to distraction. There are library branches, the Park Street branch, the Brooklyn Heights branch of the library. The main library itself is getting the interior torn out of it over the objections of the community. PS 199, a beautiful, architecturally significant school, being sold off to developers.
Well, the New York Public Library is selling off their mid-Manhattan and a couple of other branches.
They're not selling the main one, but I think that they're selling
the one
two
across
of
the
their,
street.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
Right. So, and then in addition to this, you've got the city selling name rights for various parts of parks. It's a disturbing trend. And I think that the caller makes a very good point that these are really symptoms of the same problem.
Well, Brooklyn Public Library is also considering selling off some of its branches. Are the library systems separate from the city? Can they just sell off their buildings as they see fit?
As I understand it, the library system, and this was really news to me that was brought to my attention when the library plan was unveiled, but they were originally created by different trusts that were put together in a central trust, and they're administered by a non-city agency. And
so this is like a museum selling off some of its paintings. People might be upset, but they still, unless some other arrangement has been made, they have the right to do that.
Well, I don't know whether they have the right to do that. I'm sure that people are going to be challenging that because although they are independent trusts, they've also taken an incredible amount of money from the federal government and state governments. And when you do that, there are usually strings attached. And I'm quite confident that people now are examining those strings to see if there is a way that they can force these organizations to keep the libraries open.
Eileen from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a community gardener in LaGuardia Corner Community Gardens. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Hi. And I just want to say that for years, all of our gardeners had people who visited our garden sign a petition. We had like 7,000 people signing to say to move the garden from DOT to parks. And it was always blocked by NYU to move that. So I'm just saying, you know, there's a lot of back room elbowing going on with some of the situations with moving parks to where they should be.
Well, are community gardens considered parks? Because we've been, I remember I mentioned earlier Rudy Giuliani trying to take over some community gardens and build on them, and there was a big outcry. But this is a continuing process, isn't it?
The short answer is they're parks. They should be protected as parks, but we need the courts to declare that to be true. The Bloomberg
Many of them were started on empty lots, and then local people decided that they were eyesores, and they have been converted to community gardens.
They have been, with the city's express encouragement in some circumstances, and at least its acquiescence in others. But the main point is, these people were doing a service. These were blighted areas where they turned them into vibrant community resources.
And now that the area has appreciated in value, the people want them back.
Yeah, exactly right. And I'll tell you this. If these were federal dollars that went into these parks, the federal government would never stand for it. But somehow, because it's work, sweat, and money from people's pockets, somehow the city thinks that it's entitled to just give it away to developers, and that's just wrong.
And that carries no legal weight, the fact that these community members have put in thousands of hours of work and their own money to improve them?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. The city thinks that that's not worth anything because it's defending these lawsuits rather than doing the right thing by saying, you know what, we're going to protect these the same way we protect other parks.
What about the city's practice of putting parkland under the control of development corporations and conservancies?
Well, so one of the things that if you care about your local park that you should pay attention to is whether there's some sort of corporate-like structure that is involved in managing the park, because then you will know that you need to be on your guard. These development corporations, conservancies, they're often not they don't have the same transparency, visibility, sunlight than a city agency would. And God knows, as we've seen through this litigation, even city agencies present some opacity. So not that all conservancies are bad, not that all development corporations are bad, but if there is one that is put in control of your park, you need to be aware of that, and you need to monitor the situation to see what they're doing.
Does the city see this as a win-win situation, allowing some development to bring in the funds to maintain the parks?
They do. I mean, and I think from a pure public policy perspective, as long as the private interests that are contributing to the park understand that it's no different than making a charitable contribution, once you give the money, you're done, there wouldn't be a problem. The problem is control. With the private money coming into the park, there's some giveaway of control that ultimately allows a foot in the door, ultimately resulting in the park either changing, shrinking, or going away completely.
Is that what's happening with the Hudson River Park?
The Hudson River Park is certainly, I think the community has been pretty active there in trying to fight to maintain the park. But with that and with Willits Point and with Flushing Meadows, it's going to take a lot of organization and effort to prevent the development plans from going forward.
Now, there are also, with zoning, a lot of areas that were intended to be made into parks are now being used instead to build high-rise apartments, especially along the Williamsburg waterfront. What are the precedents on those things?
I think there really aren't a lot of precedents yet. If it was only zoned intended but without being declared a park and never used as a park, I think it's going to be more difficult to prevent development in those areas.
Bernie from the Bronx, how are you on the air?
Yes. We have just above Co-op City Boulevard, there's a wooden park, and it appears that the senior citizen housing development has, out of sight, taken over a whole section of that park, and we'd like to know what authority they had, whether they had the right to do that, whether they were sold to them or by the city, or whether they did it illegal. We don't know. How do we find out then and try to recoup that piece of property?
Well, there are two things that you need to do, Bernie. First, you need to call the Parks Department and try to get a Parks Department representative out to speak to the community, which they should do. If you're organizing a group and there's a group of people that care about this, the Parks Department is responsible to you. They answer to you the same that they answer to everyone in the city, and you should be able to get straight answers. But unfortunately, you may not be able to get straight answers for them, particularly if they want to develop this in a way that's not consistent with parkland protection. So you can file something. It's very easy to file. You can do it over the website, something called a Freedom of Information Act request, and they have to respond to what's called a FOIA request.
Now, you've been involved in a lot of different kinds of pro bono cases, not just involving parklands, also Social Security, disability, food stamps. How do you choose the cases you take on?
I try to be inclusive. I have got a very large pro bono docket, and I believe fundamentally that people have a right to challenge their government when their government does bad things.
So it's always a matter of suing the government?
Well, it's not always suing the government, but oftentimes it's either suing the government or challenging some rule or practice that's hurting people.
And you even chose to challenge Maya Bloomberg's fight to change term limits to secure his third term.
I was certainly part of that case with my partner, Randy Mastro. It's one of my greatest professional regrets is that we lost that case.
What do you get out of it? Do pro bono cases give you a chance to set legal precedents?
Well, I think I do it mostly because I I feel as though we're a very good law firm and we can help people right wrongs. Certainly some of our cases set precedent, but oftentimes it really is the quiet victory where you settle a case and ultimately, without a lot of fanfare, get people some right that they really should not have had to go to court to vindicate.
Now, we don't have much time, but people have been calling in about the South Street Seaport. Is that also in danger of being commercialized?
I haven't followed the South Street Seaport specifically.
But and people have been calling it about Union Square. Union Square, there was that big fight over whether there could be a green market.
Absolutely.
What position would you have taken on that?
Well, in all of these circumstances, what you're seeing in every one of these, it is in a microcosm, it's a bigger problem. People are trying to fight to protect the very limited space that they have in order to enjoy days with their families. And in every one of these circumstances, you'd think that the city parks officials are there with your back. They're trying to protect you. And all too often, you're having to fight against the very people who are stewards.
Jim Walden will be speaking at the New York City Community Garden Coalition's forum this Saturday. There'll be a link to the information on our show page at WNYC.org. He is the head of pro bono litigation for the law firm Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, we'll see what can be done to protect the estimated 100,000 patients who are affected by preventable medical errors or infections. And then Jim Parsons drops by to talk about his hit TV series, The Big Bang Theory, and the upcoming HBO version of Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart. Also, Rachel Kushner on her new novel, The Flamethrowers, and Bali Nasser, who used to be senior advisor to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, on why he feels American foreign policy is in retreat. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan's the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. We had help today from Maria Barberi, Todd McGovern, David Shane, and contributing producer Barbara Kahn. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.